at the moment, we're considered to be in a hard market and prices are increasing and you know, coverage and capacity is reducing. That is a direct reflection on the fact that we've paid so many claims. The policies have historically been, you know, cut, aren't being profitable anymore for insurers. You know, we see things like, you know, the headlines come across where such and such insurance policy declines a cyber claim. And quite often it's because they've, you know, seen a few in the press, particularly in the US, you know, they pulled out the war exclusion or something along those lines. And it annoys me because the headline is wrong. Mm-hmm. It's not that cyber doesn't pay. Almost every one of those that I've seen, it's a non-cyber policy declining a cyber event.
Do you want to hear about the latest developments in the cyber market and learn best practices and thought leadership from cyber insurance and security experts? We talk all things cyber insurance industry, international growth, cyber claims, and more. Welcome to the Cybersecurity and Insurance Leaders Podcast.
Welcome, James. Pleasure to have you on the show. Always really enjoy getting the chance to speak to people from an underwriter. So thanks a lot for coming.
Welcome. Nice to be here. Thank you, Anthony.
So I guess to sort of kick things off, what can you tell me about yourself, your company, and your team?
So I work for Mosaic Insurance. We are a new insurance company. We're only just over a year old, HQ'd out of Bermuda. We specialize in specialty lines only. So we don't do property, casualty, et cetera. Our focus products are M&A, cyber, FI, PI, political risk, war, and terrorism. And we're an international-based insurance company with offices in Bermuda, the US, and the UK currently.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for that. Sounds pretty interesting. You know, so I guess you're, you know, pretty global in terms of the geographies, it sounds like, you know, with your offices, you know, and kind of the different big markets. Are there, in terms of where you're selling your policies into, are there any particular markets you really, really focus on?
So at the moment, as you say, we've got four offices in three countries. The expectation is we'll soon be launching offices in the Middle East, Europe, Singapore, and Canada to make us a truly international insurance company. That said, you know, I'm head of international cyber, so my region is ex-US. So I kind of manage the product and the underwriting teams outside of the US. So all of those offices just mentioned. But because we are based in Bermuda and London, you know, we are an international insurer. So we can cover and look at policies and risks, you know, all over the world. We are based upon as a Lloyd's syndicate, which gives us that capability.
Okay. Great. Yeah, I think that's always been one thing that I find really interesting and great about Lloyd's is just the way you can write policies in so many countries.
It's my favorite part of the job. Mm. You know, managing people in all these different jurisdictions, meeting clients from around the world, that getting different cultures and different aspects and different ways of working. It's a fantastic element of insurance, and Lloyd's is that international piece. It's what I love doing.
Right. So in terms of, I guess, client size, then what are you really focused on?
So we focus on mid to large corporate entities, so 200 million plus ish in revenues for the cyber line of business.
Okay. Good to know. In terms of strengths, you know, just looking just at cyber or, you know, something related to cyber. So if you're sort of mixing and matching different covers, you know, what would you consider your company's strength?
One is the international breadth, certainly. Two is very much our underwriting bench. You know, we are a very considered a high-end underwriting unit. So we take all accounts on their own measures. We really focus on what that insured is, what they does. We have very few arbitrary rules in place. You know, we take each account on its merits. And the third element is we're very much set up as an insurtech. So we have partnered with DXC to set up our systems to make us as future focused as we can be on the technology side. So, you know, utilizing the data we have, utilizing modern techniques, AI, you know, machine learning to really enable us to underwrite in the most, you know, in the best possible way using all the modern techniques that are available.
Okay. Interesting. So I guess it's a mix of a few different things. I think certainly, you know, it's interesting starting a full insurance company. You know, we see a lot of young insurtech MGAs, and I think it's a little bit distinct how, you know, you guys seem to have a lot of the same things, but are more of a traditional insurer on maybe larger clients.
Yeah, there is a number of insurtechs at the moment, and most of the ones that I know have come a bit from the tech angle. So they're a technology company first that utilize that tech to get into insurance. We are an insurance company first and foremost. You know, we are a Lloyd's syndicate, and we are then partnering with the technology to enable that underwriting. So we kind of reversed our way into it.
Makes sense. So I guess, you know, kind of jumping into some of the details in what you guys do. You know, I read a lot of cybersecurity press, and coming from the insurance world, it's always, well, you know, I guess people know my opinions on claims, you know, I'll ask you, you know, hearing all these things within cybersecurity press about cyber insurers not paying claims or, you know, maybe fighting a lot to not want to pay a claim. You know, what are your thoughts on that? Like, what are you seeing in terms of claims?
Yeah, that is a good question, and one that always bugs me. Only in that cyber insurance has proven time and again, it does pay. You know, at the moment, we're considered to be in a hard market and prices are increasing, and you know, coverage and capacity is reducing. That is a direct reflection on the fact that we've paid so many claims. The policies have historically been, you know, aren't being profitable anymore for insurers. You know, we see things like, you know, the headlines come across where such and such insurance policy declines a cyber claim. And quite often it's because they've, you know, seen a few in the press, particularly in the US, you know, they pulled out the war exclusion or something along those lines. And it annoys me because the headline is wrong. Mm-hmm. It's not that cyber doesn't pay. Almost every one of those that I've seen, it's a non-cyber policy declining a cyber event. So it's quite often a property policy or an all risks policy that is excluding a cyber event. So it should say property policy doesn't pay cyber, but what it says is cyber doesn't pay. Right. It's like asking a cyber insurance policy to pay a motor vehicle loss. You know, you crash your car, you don't, you know, cyber excluded it and said we didn't pay. Mm. The headline would be cyber doesn't pay motor loss, but it should be, you know, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. You really need to get under the skin of those events. It does pay, you know, after NotPetya, there was a Lloyd's survey done around who was paying NotPetya claims because one of these headlines came out. And it turns out that the average payout at the time was 90% of claims were paid.
Okay.
90. I mean, that's higher than most other business. So it definitely does pay. You know, it's just that cyber is a complex area. It is a peril. And by that, you know, if cyber is a peril, like fire is a peril, it can affect all sorts of different policies in all sorts of different ways. Cyber insurance is specifically designed to pay cyber losses, particularly financial loss resultant. Other policies have not necessarily considered that as an aspect of their exposure. And you need to understand, if you want property damage to pay cyber as a peril event, you need to make sure that the wording is built for that. Okay. 10 years ago, 5 years ago, they weren't. Now they are getting much better and they are being much clearer on whether they include or exclude cyber as a peril. But yeah, cyber does definitely pay. The insurance industry has felt it the last few years.
Yeah, it's I think the losses are pretty interesting. You know, you sort of look at it, you look at the growth of the cyber market, and you know, I'm not sure anybody could have predicted 5 years ago, even though there was, you know, you mentioned NotPetya, that was 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure anybody could have predicted how quickly the losses could become very big because the attackers changed. You know, it wasn't lack of understanding of underwriters at that point. It was just the actual threat changed a lot.
It was very much so. And it all came back down to their capability to add a worm variant into ransomware as an attack. Previously, ransomware, we as an underwriting community, we weren't too concerned with because an attacker could get into a computer and they could encrypt a computer.
Yeah.
But you lose one or two computers and there's no real massive loss. That worm variant, which was stolen by the hacking community from the US, that enabled it to spread horrifically. You know, it go from one computer into your whole network, and it absolutely dynamically changed the entire exposure from ransomware, and has led to where we are.
Yeah, absolutely. So, it you know, I'm definitely with you. I didn't want to lead you on that one, but that is especially when I would read in the cybersecurity press. That's one of those things that just drove me crazy, because in my experience was that unless it was something just completely out of left field that was clearly not covered, you know, you were going to get your claim paid if you had a cyber policy.
I know I've only ever outright declined one claim. And that was very much for misrepresentation. You know, they said they had all these controls and all these securities, and they patched and they updated, and it turns out they were nowhere near that spec. And we could prove if they had the spec that they said they had, the event would have happened. The only one I know I've ever declined.
I suspect we may see a little bit more declining happening, but that just comes down to the, you know, it's well known up front on the underwriting side that if you don't have this or you don't have that, and we're underwriting you with the theory that you do, you know, multi-factor authentication, you know, is probably a good example, or, you know, there's probably others. You know, this is probably not going to be covered, but it's very clear up front. It's not a trick sort of situation where somebody at the end is going to decline you.
The wordings are reasonably clear. You know, if an event of this type happens, we will pay unless, you know, huge misrepresentation or, you know, a couple of other clauses. Now, we may not pay every type of loss or every cost that comes out of that. And that may be where occasionally you see the disputes is evaluating the payment. But it will always pay, you know, the cost to get you up and running. It will always pay the cost to get your systems fixed. It's then a question of, you know, how much did you actually lose? You know, in business interruption, it's quite a complex calculation. How much income did you lose during that period? So it's a question of how much, not if. More often than not.
Makes a lot of sense. I guess, you know, kind of getting out of the question of coverage then, you know, there's a lot of questions over the years. You know, people are starting to understand more and more over the last few years of what a cyber policy is and what it should cover. But there's still, it's often been confusing for, you know, people that aren't familiar with it. You know, what is this policy? What does it cover? What are your thoughts in terms of how the market's evolved and where do you think it'll go in the future?
Interesting one. Going back, you know, a dozen years, cyber policies were designed very expressly to cover data breach losses. You know, GDPR and other similar personal, you know, information laws were coming through. They weren't picked up necessarily in professional indemnity type financial loss policies because there may not be negligence, you know, in that. And so we had to come away from that trigger and just, you know, the event happened almost parametric, like the data's out there, therefore there's a loss. They were expanded over the years to cover more and more things, you know, liability resultant, particularly the move into business interruption was a massive change. You know, if your system, and again, driven by things like ransomware, it became very clear if your system fails, and, you know, so many companies, almost every company now is a tech company, they're all driven by tech. If that tech doesn't work, your company doesn't operate. Now, in property, you had business interruption for physical events, but not non-physical. So it was very expressly designed to cover these new things, these new areas of loss that no other policy ever covered. And that's where I think it is now and kind of where it needs to stay. We've had arguments for years that they should cover more, that it should cover everything resulting from a cyber event, you know, cyber all risks type of cover. You know, they tried to put, you know, crime in there, you know, standard fraudulent crime. Oh, well, it came via a computer. They sent me an email rather than defrauded me over the phone, or rather than, you know, the old school, they knock on the door and they try and sell you a dodgy diamond, you know, going way back years and years. It's all fraud. They're all stopped by processes, not by security. Okay. And that came in and has now gone back out because, funnily enough, you can buy a crime policy that is designed to cover crime. Property damage is the other big one that they've keep trying to put, you know, brokers and clients are saying, well, why can't you cover property damage within it? Property damage is an incredibly complex but well-known area of loss. you know, there are a dozen different types of policies specifically for covering different types of property, despite the fact it's a very well-known historical area of loss. You don't just buy a property or risks policy. You buy a standard property policy, but then if you have worries about terrorism as a peril, you buy a terrorism property policy. If you're worried about war, you buy a war one. If you're a marine environment, you buy a marine one that covers hull. That, you know, something that's so well known is sold in 12 different policies. Cyber is incredibly complex and changing. We can't cover every element of loss in one place. We can't provide the capacity. You know, property policies, they buy billions in limit. The cyber market doesn't have that capability. Mm. We can't understand all those. You know, you'd end up with 17 different underwriters for one policy because you'd each have to understand each different type of peril, type of loss type. Mm-hmm. And it'd become far too complex, far too expensive, and it wouldn't go anywhere. So I think keep cyber where it needs to be. Covering those elements of loss, the financial loss resulting from systems going down or being breached or having data losses. And if you're worried about property resulting from cyber as a peril, look at your property policy or look at your crime policy if you're worried about crime. Focus on cyber as a peril in other policies and make them cover what they know, but with a new type of loss. I've been arguing this for years. It seems to have settled. I hope that continues.
So just in terms then of like all sorts of things that can cause a system outage, you know, what are your thoughts on that, covering that?
Now, system outage can be caused by multiple type events. And to a degree, cyber does pick up if your tech system has been, you know, brought down by certain physical like perils, like bricking, for example. Mm-hmm. Because we understand in bricking, again, it isn't really property damage. The property itself isn't physically damaged. It's the coding within it. Mm-hmm. If you're going to go beyond that, we can cover and do cover system failure for most individual insured reasons. The area where it starts to get a little more complex is when you have big overarching kind of aggregated type events. So, for example, a system failure, you know, system goes down, for example, if the power's turned off. But if the power's turned off to your individual insured, you know, because you made a mistake, that, again, can occasionally be covered depending on the wording you have. But if the power goes down because the nuclear power station down the road is just turned off and everyone's lost power, that gets beyond anything we can underwrite. Mm-hmm. And beyond anything that we can look at specifically. It's not you as an insured had a problem. It's the environment as a whole had a problem. And that's where it starts to fall down and that we cannot cover those type of elements, war being another particularly very topical one at the moment.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So I guess just looking at cyber underwriting, you know, what in your mind, how could it be better?
Cyber is quite unique in how it needs to be underwritten. And it's something certainly that we can get better at as an industry. You know, ransomware caught us all on the hop is a great example. You know, having literally just mentioned it about the fact that, you know, it was an individual event that became a systemic event. Cyber is one, you know, it's the old argument, it's a bit of a war. It's them versus us. And it evolves, you know, you go back to the old adage, you know, you bring a knife to a fight and they bring a spear and then you bring a bow and arrow and they bring a gun. It's constant back and forth between who can get one over on the other.
Okay.
And we need to, as an industry, be prepared for that. You know, if you're looking at one of the more traditional policies, you have hundreds of years of data, you know, earthquakes and you know, tornadoes don't really change that much over time. They change very slightly. But if you're West Coast property, you know there's going to be some earthquakes. You've got the stats on fairly how regular they are, what in you know insurable interest you have in that region, and you can understand it over time. We can't do that in cyber. But as we've just discussed, 5 years ago, it wasn't an issue, and now it is. What's going to be the next thing in the next 5 years? What's going to be the thing 5 years after that? So whilst we need to keep an eye looking at history and what's come through, we need to do that on a basis of understanding the world today. But we constantly need to be looking forward. where is the next trend going? What is the new type of attack vector? What's the new type of loss that we're going to see? And hence the wording needs to evolve, the underwriting needs to evolve, and we need to spend more and more time looking forward than any other line I know. And that is a real key part. And that has to be understood within, you know, the regulators that we have, our own insurance companies, is we're never going to get it right every time. You know, we're not crystal ball gazers. We can't predict the future with 100% certainty, but they have to understand, you know, like ransomware, you're going to have these blips where something comes through and we have to learn from it, manage it, understand it, and bring it back down the other side into the realms of, you know, insurability.
Okay. So I guess, you know, it's interesting then, you know, kind of looking forward, you know, how do you think, you know, cybersecurity side of things, how could that be better managed?
In a similar manner, you have to be looking forward, and bottom line is you have to start investing in it. It takes, you know, you can't just turn around, especially if you're a big company, you know, the old phrase, you know, it's trying to turn a tanker. If you're a large company and, you know, global activities, you know, thousands of computers, it is not an easy thing to secure. You can't just go, oh, I need better insurance, I need better security, and by next week it's done.
Yeah.
It takes time, it takes research, it takes money, it takes effort.
Okay.
And you sit there and go, well, these are what I'm worried about today, so I'm going to put this security in place that helps me today, and I'm done. Yeah. No, you're not done. You're done today.
Right.
What's the thing you're going to be looking for tomorrow? Where's the next big ransomware coming through? What security do I need to protect against that? Constantly evolving in that same space. You know, too many industries and companies, they rely on technology. They really cannot do what they need to do without technology anymore. We're not, you know, manufacturers where I was like, well, we're manufacturing, we're a very manual process. No, you're not. Everything is driven by software. Everything is connected and networked by software. People aren't sitting in the factory with a big green go button and a big red stop button. Someone is programming that. And yet, you know, all of your value, so much of your value as a company is reliant on this technology. But for years, the security of that has been undervalued. And it's only now people are beginning to wake up, because, and generally because they've had a ransomware type event and it's cost them a lot of money. And they go, we should have protected. Yes, you should have done. That's the real big thing now, is you've got to get on the front foot and you've got to keep going. It is not a one day or a 1 year thing. It is going to be an eternal cycle that you have to be aware of. And the management of those companies have to factor that in on a daily basis. It's getting better, but it's still a long way to go. So many insureds we see are what I consider on a journey. A year ago, we did a review. We realized that security wasn't up to standard, and we're now trying to improve it. And these are the 17 things we've done, and these are the 28 things we're going to do. Everyone needs to be on that journey, and everyone needs to be coming out the other side.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I guess, what would you say your biggest concern is?
Funnily enough, having talked about it so much, ransomware isn't my biggest concern. If we look at going back to what I was just saying about looking forward and looking at today, ransomware is the issue of today. You know, we have a much better understanding of how it works, what, you know, hackers do to enable it, what controls and flaws and security issues can mitigate or exacerbate a ransomware issue. We know roughly how much it's going to cost to fix it. And you throw in, you know, some of the societal changes we see today, you know, around cryptocurrency rules and sanctions on payments and things like that. And it is a cycle. And I, you know, ransomware, you know, my personal opinion, we've kind of hit a peak and we're beginning to come down the other side of understandability and, you know, the ability to insure it and continue to insure it going forward. So hence my biggest concern is, what's the next big thing?
Okay.
And for me, my biggest concern, and talking about this internally, is actually data and liability. If we go back, you know, to where policies originated, it was around data breaches. And that's where most of the losses were derived pre-2017.
Okay.
But what we're now seeing is court cases coming through with some very large liability payments coming off the back end, you know, $300-400 million. The problem is, as with anything in law, it takes 5 to 7 years for the law, for the court cases to go through court, for the law to decide and think about that event and think about what it means and to come to an adjudication and to set a precedent. So those data breaches we thought were done, you know, 2015, 2016, there were some really big data breaches. We thought they were done. You know, we've paid the costs, we've notified the people, we've complied with the law. Oh, no, now we've got to pay another $200 million. Now, they're only the first few coming through. There were lots of data breaches. There still are data breaches. If those court cases now are beginning to set precedent, and those liability numbers are true, there is definitely a case of concern that, you know, policy years we thought were done, you know, the profits were made or not, are now going to come back around and bite us. So over the next 2 or 3 years, you're paying claims from events from 5 or 6, 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That is a real concern for me.
Right? Yeah.
So
you think it's going to be short tail and instead it ends up a very long tail?
Precisely. Mm-hmm. Data breaches were always considered relatively short tail. Ransomware events are considered relatively short tail. You know what the problem is. You fix it, you pay the cost, and you move on. Now you've got this long tail element coming back around. And that is going to have to be factored into our underwriting and our pricing going forward if it holds.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. So I guess let me pivot a little bit from that. What would you say the metrics are that are most important to you in your day-to-day role?
So when looking at underwriting and what am I looking for? First and foremost, from me, and this goes back to when I was taught underwriting years and years ago. I've always been in professional indemnity, and it came down to your kind of risk culture, your risk management culture, how risk aware is it insured. You can put all the right things on a proposal form, but you need to get beyond that into understanding the insured and how they really view risk.
Okay.
Is that, you know, do they pay at lip service? Do they tick the boxes and do the minimum required just to make sure they get through the gate? Or are they really risk aware? You know, from the CEO down, are they concerned about the different exposures they have? Are they concerned about the risks they're going to face? Do they actively want to manage and get ahead of those to find the next big thing and be ahead of it? So it's trying to find, and that's a really hard thing to understand,
okay,
especially if a lot of the stuff we do is remote. You know, you need to be able to speak to a client, see them, and understand how much they really care.
Mm.
That's the overarching piece. You know, if you want to get into the specifics of what I'm looking for and what cyber underwriters are looking for today, you know, the tick boxes to make sure they've ticked, understanding your data is still, you know, up there, particularly because of the data issues we're now seeing. You know, what do they have? Do they really protect it? Do they secure it, segregate it? If you're in manufacturing or industrial processes, IT and OT segregation.
Okay.
You know, that's a huge thing now. Everything's been around networking. You know, can I control that factory remotely? But that is a huge backdoor into your system. Segregate the elements. Access controls like MFA, PAM and PIM, backup segregation is a massive focus right now. Ransomware can go through your system and into your backup. And if it takes out your front system and your backup system, it's not really a backup. So making sure your backup is segregated, preferably air-gapped. Patching, as we mentioned, keeping ahead of the game, keeping yourself updated. Oversight, you know, having a SOC, a SIEM, an MSSP, someone who's getting eyes on, you know, the front doors and what's going on in your system, rather than just, you know, hoping that no one gets in. Make sure someone's actually looking that no one gets in. You know, it's the difference between having an alarm on your building and having a video camera with someone permanently watching it. That's a big piece for me. Overall IT security budget, you know, that needs to be a decent number. You see, occasionally you get an insured through and they're $10 billion in revenue and they spend $1 million a year on security. I'm like, you, going back to what we've just said, your IT and your software and your technology is everything to you, and yet you pay it so little attention. You know, those kind of numbers are actually really telling. And then putting all that together in a holistic view. So, you know, how does this affect your particular entity, and how have you made sure you've protected the crown jewels? You know, that they're the questions you're going to get asked by every underwriter in cyber right now. And if you don't stack up on those, you're going to struggle to get insurance.
Okay, interesting. It must be difficult, you know, kind of coming in from the outside and trying to understand, you know, without being able to get into the detail exactly what somebody's situation is. In terms of, you know, because you're kind of coming in from an outside perspective.
It is, you know, in an ideal world, you know, you could use telematics as quite a good example. You know, that at the moment a lot of the information we get is, especially using technology, you heard about, you know, outside in scanning tools and software that detects the endpoints of insured and that's right. Information. But what we actually need is inside out information. What's going on inside your network? You know, what data have you got? Where is it? How do you control it? How do you segregate it? And at the moment, the only way we can get that is manually. You know, we ask questions and you give us a response. You know, you could go to the nth degree of telematics and you put software inside certain companies' architecture that gives you that information live without asking any questions. There is software that can do elements of that today, but like telematics, no one wants it in their system.
Right.
No one wants to have someone constantly looking over them and potentially changing their insurance, you know, at renewal because, well, we saw that you did this. We don't like that.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a catch-22.
Yeah. It's true. You think about it, you know, in the automobile is probably a relatively simple one to solve versus a giant corporate network in terms of being able to monitor what's going on. And yeah, nobody wants to be monitored like that.
Unfortunately not. It would make our lives easier, but we have to work within the parameters we're allowed.
Certainly. So let me ask you this. If you could change something in how the industry works, what would it be?
Actually, that relates to our last point on that data gathering element. You know, it is difficult to get the information we need. You know, first and foremost, what the information we need is generally highly technical. You know, it's very tech specific. You know, CEOs, CFOs won't know the answer. So we end up having to go through tech departments and they don't always necessarily know the business impact of what they're answering. So it's quite difficult to do. You then throw in, you know, recent events, you know, ransomware, et cetera, and the question sets have got a lot more complex, a lot longer. You then throw in, you know, as an industry, and this is something that we really have to focus on, you know, a number of insureds insist upon having their particular proposal form or their particular application. Right. Now, partially it's because they trust their questions better than others. Mm-hmm. But it also comes down to things like, you know, they want to be able to, they believe that's the question set they need to get a large data pool of information, which gives them an ability to, you know, make overarching decisions about certain trends or software flaws that end up in claims. You know, so they may use web scraping, for example, which means they have to have their form every time to make sure they get that exact information in the exact format they need. The problem is multiple insurers and I see clients who filled in like 5, 6, 7 different application forms. 90% of the information is the same. But if they want that insurer, they must have that form. And so someone is having to fill these in. You know, no one ever likes buying insurance. It's not something you get excited about. So we need to make it as easy as possible in an area that is complex and difficult, and we are making it harder. We have to find a way as an industry to come together and agree on the question sets we need and the format we need it so that all of us can use the same forms irrespective. I do think we need to move into that in some way. I mean, technology and software can help because it's enabling us to get information without asking questions.
Okay.
But we're always going to need questions. And yeah, I hear this as a complaint regularly from brokers and clients that we are making life so difficult for them to answer this. And we need to improve in that area.
Okay, interesting. So I guess, you know, some other questions I wanted to ask. You know, there's sort of some things going on, some topical things in the industry in terms of, you know, probably two things. One, you know, we're hearing a lot about talent scarcity. Mm-hmm. And probably the other one is you know, talked a little bit about it earlier, some of the aggregation risks. So I guess starting with the war for talent, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a challenge. And it is, you know, we forget that cyber is still a relatively nascent industry, particularly comparative to, you know, other lines of business. And we're in the same spot as cybersecurity professionals are in. You know, the need for cyber insurance has grown massively, which means that the companies that need to provide cyber insurance, underwriters, brokers, whoever, need to expand similarly. You know, you can't just keep selling more and more of it without more people. The problem is that growth in expectation and need is, you know, good old Keynesian supply and demand is far higher than the supply. Mm. It takes years of experience to become a very good underwriter. You know, you don't learn it overnight. And it takes years to become a good broker, it takes years to become a good cybersecurity professional. You need experience and time and training. And that lag is causing a massive problem in the industry. I mean, 10, 15 years ago, you know, there was hardly, there was a small group of us in London who used to write this. Now there's hundreds of people and we need hundreds more, but you can't just find hundreds of people. So there's a big talent war, particularly when experienced people, you know, there's a bigger group of people, or underwriters, brokers with 3, 4, you know, 5 even years of experience, because we started the staff up 4 or 5 years mm-hmm. ago. But if you want a solid market lead, someone with 10 years experience, there's hardly anyone around.
Right.
So you're either poaching off other people, or you're over-promoting underqualified, or you, and I'm having to, you know, I'm in the same boat. I'm trying to expand a brand new company. Yeah. You know, you're having to take people, you know, who are younger and train them, which takes time and energy. And I've trained so many people.
Yeah.
It is difficult. And unfortunately, there is nothing you can do very specifically to get around that, other than keep investing in new people, keep bringing people in the industry, keep growing that gene pool. And eventually the lag will ease and we'll have enough once the growth eases.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I was going to say that is the challenge. You know, it is growing so fast. And, you know, certainly on the security side, I think it's been a hot market ever since I entered the workforce, and I'm not young. So it's, you know, that probably hasn't changed. And then, you know, the insurance is probably 15 years behind. You know, as you said, I can think back just, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago, and we probably fit all, you know, everybody working in something related to cyber insurance, we could all fit in a room, you know, a big room, but it was still a room. And so, yeah, it's probably creating some really interesting challenges as it keeps growing.
It really is. But we will get through it. So yeah, there's a lot of us out there growing and training and building people. But it's just, yeah, in the intervening period, it's tough.
Hmm. So I guess, you know, the other part of that question then is aggregation. You know, everybody's been talking about aggregation for years, you know, probably as long as I've been doing anything in cyber insurance. But it still seems like it's even probably a bigger focus than it ever was. And people are perhaps even more worried about it than they ever were before. What are your thoughts on some of those challenges?
Yeah, that's a really tough one. And something that we Mosaic are particularly interested in working on. You know, it's come to the fore more because there have been more aggregated events. You know, there's been a number of tech kind of zero day type flaws, particularly in tech software or security providers. That means it affects everyone who uses their security. I mean, more recently, you've had Log4j. You know, these are events, you know, we've gone from having no aggregated events to having 4 or 5 in a year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, they've been on the smaller end, and actually they haven't resulted in mass hysteria and losses all over the place because people are so much more aware in patching and updating and securing. It's not been as bad as thought. But they are around and they are growing in frequency and severity. So it focuses the mind. Especially then you have something like a war going on, and that in itself is an aggregated event. So it regulators, insurers are all concerned about it. The problem is it's incredibly difficult and complex. You know, you go back to the standard, you know, an aggregated event in property is reasonably calculable because it has a perimeter. Mm-hmm. Everything had, you know, how many properties do I insure in California or, you know, Florida that are likely to get flooded? You can calculate that because you know the edges. We don't know the edges. Mm. We don't know the connection points. We haven't got the granularity of data to know what connects to who, when, and how. It's where we're trying to get to. And this is something that we've actually been kicking off a project here at Mosaic a little while ago, because it's something that we really want to bring to the fore, is how can we get through this? And you have to start off with base principles. You know, what data do we get today? And what inferences and things can we tell with that data? What data do we think we need? How do we get those data sets? In what format? How do we make sure that we can put it into a format that means we can actually learn from it? It's no good having 78,000 PDF proposal forms unless you want someone to actually look through 78,000 proposal forms. You need to put it into a format that can be interrogated. So it's, what data do you need? What have you got? Where can you get it from? How can you get it? How can you put it into a format you can actually use it? And then what do you do once you have it? You know, that's getting into the realms of actuary and data science, something historically isn't massively being done in insurance outside of the traditional lines. You know, it's something that we massively need to move into, is getting the proper technology to get the data, to put it in a format that's interrogatable with people and eyes on who have the ability to make those inferences, all to get an answer. Mm-hmm. That says roughly this. It's a long piece. It's not something that's going to be resolved overnight and cannot be resolved overnight. But, you know, the companies are moving in that direction. We are gathering the bits of data. We are working on the technology that allows us to do it. And it's something that we're going to be focusing on, you know, bringing in AI and web scraping and data pools to try and get to that answer. But it's taking time.
Okay. Sounds like you guys have a lot of interesting things going on. Makes sense, you know, the partnership you have with Dixie.
Massively so, you know, have it being, and that again is one of the raison d'etre of why we are partnering and want mm-hmm. to be an insure tech, not just an insurer, is that tech element becomes so vital in these specific, you know, these specialty lines, in enabling just that, in making those calculations possible. You cannot do it manually. You know, old paper records or even Excel spreadsheets just don't cut the mustard anymore.
Yeah.
You have to go to the nth degree beyond that to make it, you know, we at the moment we gather something like 127 data points on everything we bind, and we know it's nowhere near enough.
Yeah.
And you multiply that over thousands of risks over multiple years, and you mm-hmm. just get a feel for the size of the data set you need.
Yeah.
You can't just have somebody going, oh, it looks like there's a two. you have to have software that will then, you know, be built around that data set, and hence partnering with someone like DXE and others who will bring into the project is the only way we can see it being done.
Okay. Interesting. So just looking at some of the current events going on, what do you find super interesting, current events in cyber?
Oh, interesting question. Probably got a couple. I mean, cryptocurrencies is a conversation that's come around time after time, you know, particularly with ransomware, particularly, you know, does it facilitate crime? And, you know, are we causing our own problem? And what is the true value of cryptocurrency? You know, there's so many intrinsic questions evolved around that subject. And it is fascinating. I mean, even this week, you know, they're now talking for greater regulation because the price of cryptocurrency has fallen dramatically. Mm-hmm. You know, that hacker who thought he was sitting on millions of dollars worth of crypto now be sitting on virtually nothing.
Yeah.
And now, does that mean that cryptocurrencies we cannot break any bones. It has facilitated fraudulent payments because they are deemed to be untrackable, untraceable, a way of doing, you know, it's not leaving a sack of cash at a bus stop and hoping no one's tracking you. You know, they've moved beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
But likewise, you know, society is recognizing that this is a problem. There are greater regulations coming in. There are sanctions for cryptocurrency trading firms for trading in ransoms. You know, there are some fantastic crypto tracking kind of forensic security tech firms are doing some fascinating stuff in actually tracking and tracing cryptocurrencies through the laundering process, you know, the wash, the integration, and actually being traditional means, except no different to what people have done with cash, but they're doing it with crypto. But how do you get over some of the structural issues to make it that we can do it in a crypto environment?
Mm-hmm.
And how will that change the cybersecurity exposure that we see? Fascinating subject and one that's got some legs on it. Going back to my future subject on data, you know, just what is the value of data is still an interesting question. You know, I'm an old school professional indemnity man. You know, an indemnity means to make good loss, to put you back where you were.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we know our data is everywhere. All the changes that we have in regulation around trackers and cookies and everything else, it makes no difference. Our data is everywhere. They know where we've been and what we've clicked on and your address, your email address, your banking details almost certainly have been breached at some point.
Right.
But did you lose anything?
Yeah.
What did it cost you? Mm-hmm. Now, granted, there are events where it gets, into the fraudulent realms and people drain your bank account. Very obvious loss. Definitely need to put you back where you were. But just losing data.
Yeah.
If someone just loses my email address and some of my, even down to, what's considered sensitive data, who I voted for or something like that,
Mm-hmm.
How much does that really going to cost me or affect me? Do I deserve a payout? Should I be paid for it?
Yeah.
That's a really interesting dynamic.
it's tricky because if there's an economic value to what the attackers are doing, that's really what they're aiming at the vast majority of the time. However, we tend to look at data as something of there's value because of all the different possible ways that somebody may do something with it, even if there's no motivation for them to do it. Mm-hmm. The hacker in some foreign country without extradition does not care about your voting record. Now there may be some people that do, and they could, intend to cause you issues through that. But it is an interesting technical problem and an intelligence problem. Like, what are they actually doing? What's the reasoning?
It's a very human issue. Being concerned about this kind of thing. Where the human mind can take this and where the law courts can take this is going to be very interesting over the next decade. And if I was going to throw a real outside one in on current events, quantum is fascinating.
Yeah.
That's the 10-year issue. Quantum dots and commingling, et cetera. And I do find it fascinating. And one comment terrified me a little while back is, they're trying to build the first quantum computers, able to do hundreds of thousands, millions of computations in seconds, far in advance of anything that we can do today on regular digital. And the comment was that it makes all encryption obsolete.
Yeah.
Encryption works on the basis that you make that there are so many computations that have to be made to get to the final answer that you can't do it. It takes too long and you can't crack, brute force. Quantum erases all of that instantly because it is designed expressly to do millions of computations in a split second. And unfortunately, encryption is one of the major things that we as underwriters and the people, companies, insurers use to protect their data. It's a fundamental backbone now of data security is encryption. Mm-hmm. And yet we're building something that will completely trash all over it.
Break it all, yeah.
At which point you've got to use quantum encryption and that war I was telling you about.
The new arms race, yeah.
The new arms race, that is exactly it. That's the next level of that arms race. And scary and interesting to see where that would go.
Yeah, No, definitely. Have a few people I know are really into quantum computing, and it's an interesting area, certainly in the kinds of problems they can look to solve. So I guess a few quick rapid fire questions. How did you originally get into the insurance industry?
Luck. There are very few people I know try or, you know, grow up wanting to be in insurance. Very few people advise you to go into insurance. Careers people do not talk about going into insurance.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, having now spent nearly 20 years in it. It's been a fantastic career. And I know so many people who enjoy it as a career. Shout out to my friend Helen, who's now in New Zealand. When I was a young man and needing a job, she was working in the city. And I went, how do I get a job? And she passed along some job agencies, and you said, well, you send them your CV and they find you work. You know, I'm a naive 20-something gent at the time. And what I didn't realize is she was in claims, and the job agents she gave me were insurance-specific job agents. I spent years blaming her for getting into insurance. Now I'm very thankful.
That's
one of those things.
Everybody gets into insurance by accident.
So other than actuaries, they're the only ones I've ever met who went, I want to be an actuary and insurance.
Yeah. I guess it makes sense for, you know, if you want to solve really interesting quantitative problems, you know, like go that route. So, you know, what would you recommend to anyone who wants a successful career in insurance?
Interesting question. I suppose get stuck in. You can get stuck in your little bubble that I'm underwriting this or I'm breaking that or I'm looking at this product. I always, you know, was one of those annoying people who liked taking on the extra projects. You know, we've got a project where we need to understand how this element works, or we need a project to make sure these offices are working together nicely, or we have a community. I loved getting into those projects outside of the realms of what I do, you know, getting into claims, getting into actuarial, understanding how all these different elements work.
Okay.
It really improves you. It's having that cross-class understanding and then relating it back to your day job. Okay. And then when you throw in what we discussed earlier around the geographical element of insurance, you know, which is a global thing.
Yeah.
As I said, I lived in Toronto for 3 years. I've traveled the world, meet so many different people of all different types and backgrounds and origins and part. It's a fantastic element of the exposure. So do get out there, get stuck in, meet people, make connections, and see where you get to.
Yeah, no, it's great advice. Thanks for that. Last question. So you can directly address our audience. Is there anything that they can help you with?
Anything they can help us with? That's a really tough one to answer. Don't always blame your insurer. Generally, we're trying to do a good job. There are insurers out there who may not be quite so reputable or quite so friendly, but generally, we're trying to help. You know, we don't always get it right, but it's not always our fault. You know, be nice to us. And if you're ever at a party and someone, you ask them what they do as a job, and they say insurance, don't lose interest. Your response is, oh, you work in insurance. Oh. Anyway, it's quite a fascinating job.
It's much more fun and much more interesting than you think it's going to be.
It is. From a lot of years in it, I'm an out and out insurance guy, and I always will be. And it is a great career for people. It is far more interesting than, and it makes the world turn.
Yeah.
People forget that without insurance, so many things would crash and burn, you know, industries, sectors, segments. You know, getting your house rebuilt after that 17th earthquake, you know, it makes the world turn. And it's given a really hard time, and that's annoying, but it's life.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the show. Really appreciate your time. And it's you are the first underwriter that we've interviewed. Hope to have many more. It's really been a blast talking to everyone so far. So thanks again, James, for coming on.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me. It's been very interesting. And I look forward to seeing the final article.
If you want to learn more about our host, Anthony, or his company, Aceris, visit aceris.com. ASCERIS.com. Thanks to our friends at Savoo for producing this episode with us. See you next time.